What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
Alameda County Supervisors unanimously approved a policy-driven reparation plan for Black residents. We are joined by Deborah Gore, Chair of the Alameda County Board of Supervisors Reparations Commission. Good morning, Deborah. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me to share this extraordinary event.
Absolutely. I was reading you calling it a historic event. I would agree. Just a little bit of context for my listeners. 2020 was a year that Black folks across the country demanded a racial reckoning in this country. I personally do not believe we got that racial recognition, but we did get some things. 2020 was not all in vain. One of the conversations that gained renewed interest and some real momentum in 2020 was this conversation about reparations. Can you talk about how that conversation came about, ignited in Alameda County?
Yeah, well, there have been quite a couple of supervisors who have been really passionate about this. One with Keith Carson, who as far back as 2003, 2004, 2005, so almost 20 something years, have been trying to get a conversation about reparations. And then two other supervisors, Nate Miley. So these are longstanding African-American supervisors. So Nate Miley also, you know, easily 12, 13 years, 2010 or 11. And then lastly, not to be forgotten, is Supervisor Aliza Marquez. She's Hispanic or Latina, but she is the supervisor whose district Hayward, city that Hayward is, and Russell City. And Russell City has actually done quite a bit of reparations work and in fact have a repair fund in place. So you've got some leadership sitting in that group. And then in 2020, you know, as you say, as the nation tried to have a racial awakening, there was an apology and the discussion about setting up a reparations ad hoc committee finally voted and seated that in 2023. So, you know, we're talking decades here of leadership at the supervisory level and at the county, which holds 14 different cities. So it's quite an effort.
Reparations may be the one thing Nate and I agree on. We talk a lot, been principal struggle. But with him on this, I actually think, I'm glad you mentioned Russell City. I doubt that my listeners actually all know about Russell City. I think that that's good context. Can you talk a little bit about Russell City and that struggle there?
That's right. Well, you know, they had an enclave, which was an unincorporated part of the city of Hayward. And what the city ended up, and it was Black and Latino families who had built homes and businesses, and you know, it was a thriving community for themselves, both culturally and economically. And what the city of Hayward did basically was called their living conditions blighted, and under eminent domain took it back. The thing that makes it so pernicious is that the residents themselves have been asking for water, electricity, garbage removal, waste, you know, all of that. But the city refused to give them those services, which created the blighted situation, and then labeled it blighted and through eminent domain put industrial parkway that sits there today. But those families who now, you know, the not just the children, but the grandchildren then went to the city of Hayward, and they stood up a task force, and that task force made some recommendations, and they literally could show deeds and minutes from city council city council meetings and mayors, and that where they just said, you know, they're going to take the land. And so with all that documentation, the task force was able to demonstrate the harm, and now they're asking for the repair of the homes taken, and you know, but now it's owned by a private citizen or private entities who run that industrial park. So they're doing the good work. They're doing the really good work of trying to reclaim Russell City, which was originally, you know, built by that community, Black and brown community.
Deborah Gore, sitting on commissions, county city otherwise is often thankless, tireless work. What has driven your passion to not only sit on this commission, but chair it?
Well, I've been doing economic development work for a long time. I was in the private sector, so I was in investment banking, and then in the capital markets side, meaning the debt, which is, trillions of dollars compared to equity. Equity gets all the attention, but debt and public funds are where the trillions of dollars were. And then similarly did global project finance, where I could see, these what they call public-private partnerships, but globally we're moving quite readily. And then got to greenlining and doing that policy work. So there's always been this thread of disparate treatment and disparate impact as it related to economic development, full stop. I don't care where you are in the capital markets and where you are in trying to develop, housing, healthcare, education. It's all predicated usually on land and the acquisition or the ownership of that. And so it just, the long march as well. And then when the opportunity, Keith Carson again reached out to me and asked me if I wanted to serve. And I said, oh, this is hard work. This is hard. And he said, I know, but we got to start somewhere. And then he retired, and Nikki Fortunato Bass became the supervisor of D5, and then she said, yes, we'd like you to continue the work. And I think that the part that I didn't anticipate was that Nate and Aliza asked me to chair it. So that was the other part that became, quite engaging, but then became a heavy lift. But in any case, I was asked to serve and was happy to do so.
That's often an invisible lift. So let me tell you thank you right now for all of the
Oh.
thousands of folks to hear. Thank you for your
Well,
time.
I need to say thank you for the work that you do, in identify, because the criminal, I'll tell you, the criminal justice part, there are two big components that Alameda County, they've got a $5 billion budget, and two of the biggest pieces, one is the social services that they provide, and the other is public safety. So we're talking about $1.2 billion per year. So you are in a lane that is so fraught with harm, and and we try to prioritize the repair based on the harm and let the community tell us how to do that. So I definitely am appreciative of the work that you all do in terms of all the criminal justice work. So
I appreciate that, but this is about you.
yeah,
So,
no worries, no worries.
the headline actually that caught my eye about this is that the reparations package, you give me a better word if there is one, but the what has been put forth, what was voted on, is policy driven as opposed to individual checks driven. Can you talk about how you, which I love, because when we look at all the fighting that has happened, I mean, you can just look at San Francisco and some of the conversations that happened over there, right? The last thing that a conversation about reparations should do is pit our people against each other. This should be like a
No,
unifying moment, but money does odd things to people. How did we get to policy driven? What was that conversation like?
Yeah. And so this approach, it was both set up by the Board of Supervisors that they wanted a action plan. So our directive was to provide a plan, a roadmap, a blueprint, some way to, like, how do you navigate this space and how do you move forward, as opposed to specific recommendations, right? So the packet, or the what we the action we needed was, okay, we're going to send you a plan. You need to receive the plan and you need to accept the plan. Like, because you could receive it and say, we really don't want to work on it. But you had to receive the plan. And then you had to, what we operationalize the county to do the work. So you had to set up either it'll be, a reparations department or an agency, just like you would have, for public safety, just like you would have for some social services or health services. So, and then once you set that up, now you've, set up an infrastructure that can't just be willy-nilly pulled away. So we were asked to do that plan, and that's what we ended up doing. And then that plan, you know, tells you the policy steps to in order to execute on a plan. So I kind of categorized it as our commission was a representation commission. We represented the community, we represented the data. And now this next phase that we also got, you know, approved was the implementation. So you're going from representation of the work to implementation of the work, because now you got a plan and a roadmap and you can't say you don't know what to do.
I talk a lot about the implementation part of policy, right? So we'll fight for what we call non-reformist reforms or radical reforms, things that are outside of the box that are more directly taking on equity issues, criminal legal system issues, housing, whatever, right? And so the people push for these policies, but then we give the policy to the system that we are trying to transform. And that system often gets caught up in the way that it's always been run. And then we see policies not be as effective. So the implementation part is so important. What preventative measures are put in place to make sure implementation moves along the track that it's supposed to with this?
Well, what we tried to do in the plan was to say, you got to do an equity assessment, and not just equity, but a harms assessment every year. So if you got the report every year, and you're able to hold accountable to, okay, are the harms increasing, decreasing? What is actually happening? So that linkage to your reporting on it and you're taking action on it, and then it's transparent. So we actually, you know, we actually had 44 recommendations as it's listed as things you could do under 12 policy areas. And not the least of which was, you know, to assess each department or agency for what they're already doing. Because there are some, you know, the health department has been doing a lot disaggregated information about Black mothers, Black children, the disparate health impacts. So there are, you know, pockets of good work happening. So that's how we try to codify, okay, if you're reporting on it, one, that transparency is so important. And usually that can get stifled too. You know, can get held up by the general counsel, or can get held up by some protests. But that transparency and then that action linkage then makes that, you know, that flywheel turn. And so that's what we put in the plan to make sure that things did happen. In fact, you know, based on still listening to the community and looking at the data, those two, one, two, that they go hand in hand. There, you can't separate the two.
I mean, folks know I'm pretty jaded about stuff, but I'm pretty excited about what I'm reading. It feels like a lot of troubleshooting and forethought has got into this. I know there's a bunch of them, you just mentioned there's 12 buckets and then 43 recommendations. I am not going to ask you to run through all of them. But we got about 5 minutes left, but pick three buckets that the people should know are going to be addressed in this plan. And then maybe one, you know, recommendation or two recommendations under each one.
Mm-hmm. So what the community told us, right? So we did the quantitative and the qualitative. And so, you know, just to break it down, we had 22 community listening sessions, you know, across all five districts. And it went by issue area. So we had broad community listening sessions where we, you know, asked, you know, what's the harm you experienced? What is this? We went from the harm to the solution, and we asked the community. So of those sessions, we also did surveys. So we did both in-person surveys when you showed up. We did we probably collected 200-300 surveys at the Black Joy Parade alone. And then we had a bunch of digital surveys online, long form. And so what the community says is the economic impact, so housing, that there's because so much redlining precluded us from owning homes and continue, right, to push us into the most negative community, you know, bad air, bad water, bad land. So that ability to put Black families back into homes that they either owned or that they have the right to own was the number one issue, like get us in housing and whatever. And so the recommendation, so that's, you know, one policy area. And it's at the top of everyone's list, affordable housing, but it's different when you've actually had your home taken, right? So you need to be made whole on that. So that's, you're going to have a different, just, you know, not just low interest loans. Like, you should have no interest loans, or you should have zero down payment. There are things that we have done, you know, for white communities that now you can implement. But so one, get me stable housing, and then, you know, we can thrive from there. The second then was the criminal justice, that almost, it was like 85% of those who participated had some contact through their generations of, you know, the criminal system and contact. And we heard it, like, when we broke out, we did youth groups. So we did with EOYDC, we did it with Kingmakers, and we heard those young people tell stories. You would think they were in the 60s and 70s, how they're treated in school, how they're thrown to the ground, how they're kicked out of school. I was like, oh gosh. And they, you know, they were saying that that's a criminal justice contact for them, but it sits in the education. And then we went to, you know, the elders community, right? And then we went, so they were all like, got to do something about public safety, because even if I own a home, but I am not safe in my home. So those were those two definitely rose to the top immediately in terms of harm and repair needed. And then close behind was the health, the disparate health impact of our communities, and that they needed to be made whole, or at least have programs that were culturally competent that address. Now, you know, we're now getting into the research that's needed, because the research that's been done has not been on Black folks. It's been, you know, sort of adjacent. And then, so you get this odd healthcare. So I'd say those are the top three. And it's, and to tell you the truth, Alameda County, right? You got to stay within the jurisdiction. So Alameda County has some jurisdiction over those three elements for sure. You know, if we just talk about Santa Rita and we just talk about Sheriff's Department, I mean, you know, they're holding. And then similarly on housing, they collect our real estate taxes that, you know, then we obviously pass referendums or different ways. So those surfaced, but, you know, there are so many others in terms of culture keeping, you know, how it's been dissipated and diluted in all kinds of way that try to erase Black folks and our culture. So, you know, all of that to sort of lift up what the community had said. So I would give you those three.
Thank you, Deborah. For folks, I have so many more questions, but the next guest
that's okay.
in the waiting room. Where could people go, or is it available yet, to read the full report?
Report. Yep. The whole full plan. So it's currently we have a website. So it's Alameda County Reparations. If it should just pop up. There's the text there. We are having the report designed. So we're hoping by the, you know, August 1st, it will be fully designed. It's beautiful because it captures, you know, in all of the meetings that we have had, we obviously had a media permission. And so there's all these wonderful images of our folks throughout the whole, you know, 14 cities. And so it'll be designed and probably ready to go on August 1st. And then we'll also put that on the district supervisors, and you'll be able to get it a myriad of ways. And we also stood up our social media. So, you know, we still have Instagram and Facebook. So you'll start to see this start to generate some visibility on it.
Okay,
sure.
I have just one more question.
Okay,
sure. Said I do this, I'm always running us behind. Do you have a sense of other cities or counties across the country in terms of what has been accomplished? Like, is Alameda County one of the first counties to get some resolution on this issue? This feels
absolutely.
Like-
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We were. So there's a lot of cities doing the work. In California, you know, we've passed three reparations. Well, we're about to pass the third one, but we're starting to make some traction. You know, the state did a fabulous report. And so we built on all of that. We did not have to start from scratch. I just want to give credit to that state task force and all the work that they did, you know, and you can go to the attorney general's website and you'll see that. So we have a bunch of the framework, but we are also trying to make available Make it accessible, I guess, is the word I want. Oh, but I feel like I didn't answer the question that you asked.
You did. You did right off. You said yes. You said yes.
There's only two counties. Sorry. Fulton County and Alameda County. So Fulton in Georgia and us. Okay. And they are still in the ideation. And so we are the first county to actually pass something that's concrete that now is, you know, on the in on the record and in the books of how to do it. So we are the first county. But there are a lot of cities. Like there is a groundswell from Evanston to it. Palm Springs to Bruce's Beach in California to, you know, Russell City. So California, we're of course a bit ahead, but you know, even Tulsa has set up $150 million, I think, fund. So there's some grassroots momentum happening. And I just add this last thing though, because you know, there's so much, as soon as this stuff got posted, there's all the naysayers. But we are standing this on a constitutional argument, right? That within the Constitution, and this is the way that we use the framers, and I'm not saying founders because we are the founders, but the framers said, look, there are going to be times when legislation fails you and the court fails you, and so you have a redress, and that redress, and they call it, you know, the badges and the incidents of slavery, like it goes all the way back. So redress is like 135 years in the Constitution. So we make the constitutional argument, you know, the First Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, the 10th Amendment, the 13th Amendment, all say you have the right, you know, you don't have the right to take property without fair compensation. Boom, that's the Fifth Amendment. You don't have, you know, you can have right alongside with the freedom of speech and the freedom of religion is the ability to redress. So we are landing everything that the argument, which allows us to pull that thread from slavery to today. And I mean, so you can't say the harm don't exist.
But they are. That them peoples, they're going to say the harm didn't exist, and they're going to say that we whining, and they're going to say all that other stuff. I love that you have a rational response that is rooted in actual facts. You can't have rational conversations with irrational
people.
I put a cover on you now because morbid is coming. Thank you for standing in the gap for our
people. Okay, but thank you again for the conversation. All righty. Thank you.
We've been speaking to Deborah Gore. Appreciate you too. Deborah Gore is the chair of the Alameda County Board of Supervisors Reparation Commission. And we're going to post the links to the socials and the website where you can learn more about their amazing work. That takes us to 8:30 in the morning here on Law and Disorder. I am your host, Kat Brooks. In 2023, the city of Oakland, we have an extra person. Rich, I'm going to get to you in just about 10 minutes, my dear. All right. We have, where am I? Hi, Karen. Oh, there we go. There's who I was looking for. In 2023, the city of Oakland cleared out the largest community of unhoused people at the Wood Street encampment. The community had a store, makeshift housing, community center, governing structure, community events. They also, very importantly, had a plan that with just a little city support would have allowed them to stay, to be a model for other encampments across the city, and for them to be able to stay intact. The city refused. I and other members of my team at my other org, APTP, were witness to one of the most violent and devastating sweeps I have ever seen in my 20 years of being in the streets. While there, I would always notice this woman with a camera, quietly filming. Karen Creighton is an award-winning journalist and filmmaker of Oakland. Karen has worked for multiple news outlets, has lectured at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. She has reported on the struggles faced by Eritrean migrants in Israel and West African migration through Latin America. Much of her work is focused on displacement within the African diaspora, as informed by her identity. She is here to discuss her debut feature documentary, Wood Street, which won Best Feature at the 2026 Big Sky Documentary Film Festival. Good morning.
Morning, Kat. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for being here. And I have one name on my run sheet, and there's another name on your screen. So I'm going to let you say which name you want me to call you. We also are joined by an organizer with Wood Street Commons.
Yes, Kat, because you know me as birth name, Leger. Yes. But earlier this year, I did a pilgrimage, and so I'm now going by my spiritual name, Ifalayo.
Ifalayo.
Yes.
All right, then that is what we shall move forward with, you know. All right, Ifalayo, I'm running behind, so I'm probably not going to be able to play a piece of the trailer that I wanted to play because I want to hear from you all, but we'll link to it in the archive of the show. I actually want to start with you. How did you come to be at Wood Street, and what was your experience time there like?
It came after I lost my job and was by myself on the streets and, was in Berkeley and all over. And once I moved to Wood Street, I finally felt safe to be there. I started getting involved with like some of the activities like Cob on Wood and, just like started getting empowered to do more organizing because everybody was trying to figure out, what to do with these homeless people or what's going to help them. And it's like, ask us. So that's really what inspired us to do our own advocacy and organizing was that you should ask the people that are most affected. And yeah, from there, once they did sweep the final sweep at Wood Street, we were like, no, we still have a voice. We still want to support our folks. And so we developed the nonprofit. And so I'm still working with Wood Street now.
What's the nonprofit called?
Wood Street Commons.
Wood Street Commons. All right. That's
Yes.
for the people that need to look it up and do what people should do to support nonprofits. Karen, how did you come to be at Wood Street and then just sort of be this figure that was there all the time? And I just got to give a shout out because I deal with a lot of journalists. Would I say that she was silently filming, like just in the cut doing the work? That's what I mean. And really focusing on the people that were impacted. Tell us how you got there.
Yeah, well, like you said, I've worked a lot of different jobs in journalism. And at the time, I was working at the San Francisco Chronicle in 2022 when I was reporting on a couple different stories about Wood Street folks, kind of as they were approaching the eviction by Caltrans. And I was so inspired by what I saw there that I wanted to do more than just the daily news story. And I was lucky enough to have some savings, and so I quit my job and, spent a lot of time there. And so that was, yeah, you're right, it was a lot of time.
Indeed. I do actually want to play the clip that we have, so we're going to listen just a little bit. Let's roll that tape, please.
It's been my home for a very long time. I have blood here, sweat, tears, friends, family.
You want us to help you? You gotta help us. Done it.
I do do it. I do it every day. I just did it.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
I voted for her. Please.
I gotta run for me.
Okay, but please don't throw it away.
You can't evict 1,000 people and only have 100 shelter beds for them to go. And then the following week, go back and evict them again with no place for them to go and continue on doing this.
Who has the power here on this site right now?
We got the
Who's
power.
Telling everybody what to do? Can I talk to that person? Huh?
We're the water!
Back up, okay?
This is a gross misappropriation of my taxpayers' money. I'm not paying for you guys to come around me.
Who are you supposed to choose?
So you need all these cops for these homeless people.
Crazy. Why? 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 Why?
My hope for the future is that us in the city of Oakland can come to some sort of mutual agreement to stop doing these sweeps, stop causing so much trauma. My biggest hope is that we just survive all of this.
Wood Street is screening this Wednesday at Grand Lake Theater at 7. Is it 7? 7? At
7:30.
7:30 p.m. You can get tickets at the Grand Lake Theater website. So we heard in that the trucks, we heard the pain, we heard the screaming, we heard the arguments, we heard so much. there wasn't spaces for everyone to go. And if I'm recalling correctly, before Ken Houston's latest assault on the unhoused community, which removed the requirement for the city to have places for people to go, that was a requirement in 2023. They were supposed to have places for people to go, correct?
And what they did, though, if I could just jump in real quick, for me, I was one of the first RVs to get pulled away. They were like, look, you can go into our cabin down the street, but we'll take your RV and completely destroy it, and you have to go now. Or you can get moved way over to 66, which spiraled me into like depression. I was removed from my community. I wasn't able to like even go inside and be around my people. It was a very traumatic, you know, thing at that time. So, yeah, like when we're out there and we're living together like that, we're living together like that for safety. We're living together like that for survival. And, you know, they think they're just like getting rid of this blight, but they're ripping apart families. And I do want to say, you know, a moment of silence to all of our folks that have transitioned since that time. And another like thing that I'm grateful for is that Karen did get capture some of them in the movie. So they, you know, their spirit can live on through the movie, but that is the part that the city doesn't talk about, how these sweeps are killing us, how they're killing us. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to jump in like that, but
you're fine. And thank you, because I was going to go there, right? That people have died as a result of this, that this is an actual life or death consequences for folks, and there's so many folks still outside. The answer to homelessness, y'all, is housing. Karen, the sweep is completed, basically. A lot of the parties, many of the parties responsible, aren't around anymore or have lost contracts with cities where they were paid bazillions of dollars to torture our people. I try to behave, y'all, but it's hard. What do you hope? And we still have a massive amount of our folks outside on the streets of Oakland, and we're in the middle of Ken Houston's and Kevin Jenkins and the rest of them assault on our folks with this homeless abatement crap policy. What do you hope the film does? Like, what is, in this moment, what is your hope for the film?
Yeah, I mean, my intention, I think, in making the film, one of the main ones was really to show housed people the devastation of encampment sweeps. I think the average person who has not experienced homelessness has zero idea what an encampment sweep is like and how traumatic they are for people. So for me, it was very important to show that. Like after going there every day during the Wood Street sweep and filming, I was like, people need to see this. And I hope that can help show folks that, you know, we don't need to get people in. This is not the way to get people into housing. And it's proven that it doesn't really get people into housing. It really just further traumatizes folks.
All right. What haven't I asked you that you want to say before I move on to my next segment? I really just wanted to bring you in here, let people know they can go see this film Wednesday at Grand Lake Theater at 7:30. You can get tickets on the Grand Lake Theater website. Your closing remarks, both of you.
Well, we're also screening at the New Parkway tonight, and there might be tickets available at the door too at 6:30. I don't know, Ifalayo, do you have closing thoughts?
I just want to say, you know, that it also puts a face to who these people are. You know, it's not just Jim and Bob out there, but it's actually John and Monte and Mona, who, you know, have been like whatever a successful member of the society was at one point. And rehumanizes who we are, and also that with like genuine support and care and compassion for folks living outside, then you can help them, you know, become sustainable. And you did say that homelessness ends with housing, Kat, but it also ends with so much more, and that's the support for our people during that transition and the healing to help people, you know, from all these years of just the trauma from the city and the environment and everything. Really hope people can come out tomorrow. We have a red carpet photo op. You can meet all of us. It's going to be really big. So thank you for the opportunity for us being on the show. And I hope you come, Kat. Are you coming?
I have tickets. I'm gonna do my absolute best. Let me be transparent. It's family night.
Okay,
my,
I'm trying.
My step grandson and dude is looking at me like another Wednesday. But we will see. There will be. But I have my tickets, and there will be APTP representation.
Yes.
In my house. But it is my deepest desire. I'm so grateful for this film and for all of you. Thank you for showing
Thank
what
you.
It means to fight.
All right. Have a good day.
You too. We have been speaking to Karen Creighton, whose film is Wood Street, which won Best Feature at the 2026 Big Sky Documentary Film Festival. We're also joined by Ifilayo Harper, who is an organizer with Wood Street Commons, tonight at New Parkway, tomorrow night at 7:30 at Grand Lake Theater. You can get tickets on the Grand Lake Theater website. That takes us to 8:43 in the morning. Here in Law and Disorder, I am your host, Kate Brooks. In October of 2025, Brentwood police responded to a minor family dispute and violently detained 72-year-old Yolanda Ramirez, who died several days later. The coroner said it was natural causes. The family says the body cam footage shows different. Joining us to discuss, as well as the fight for accountability, is Rich Ramirez, Yolanda Ramirez's son. Good morning.
Good morning, Kat. Thank you for having me on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for being here. So this is our first time talking. This is your time. This isn't my time. This isn't the listener's time. This is your time. And you take as much time as you need. I Thank always you. Begin with the humanity when I talk to families, right? Your mother is so much more than this incident. And if you wouldn't mind, if it feels okay for you to tell us who she is, I believe our ancestors are here. Just talk a little bit about her as a human being.
Yeah, my mom, you know, she's the heart and soul of this family. She was, you know, a devoted woman to her family, loved her family unconditionally, would do anything, would drop anything to do something for her family, especially her grandchildren. She loved spending time with her grandchildren and watching them grow and being there. I could always remember as a kid, you know, my mom was always there, taking me to sporting events, soccer, football. My dad had to work on the weekends most of the time when I was young. So it was always my mom that was there, always rooting me on, and just a beautiful soul. She had a kind of a weird sense of humor. You know, she would laugh at herself. She was a little clumsy. So when people would fall and she would start laughing, and she would say, "Sorry, this is nothing to do with you, but you know, it just reminds me when I fall." And so she would start laughing, and she had an infectious, unique laugh. She was a great cook. I miss her cooking, and every time I, you know, come home, she was always greet me with "Mijo, hey Mijo, how are you doing?" And I miss that dearly. Miss her a lot. You know, we think about her a lot. And you know, this is a nightmare, what happened to her. And we're just trying to get justice and accountability. And you know, going through this experience, you know, I see that the justice system, there is no justice. It's just the system. And when it comes to people in power, you know, I've always known this, but kind of going through this, you know, when things happen to people in power, they'll do anything to protect themselves and not be held accountable. And you know, that's what we're trying to do, is trying to get some accountability for what had happened to my mom, because you know, she should still be here. Plain and simple, she should still be here. You know, I should see her with my dad. They were inseparable. They're always together. So it's been really tough not having her around, especially this first year. You know, a lot of firsts, you know, the birthdays, the holidays. My parents would have celebrated their 50th year anniversary on April 26th of this year, and her birthday and Mother's Day. So it's been tough. We have her ashes right now in a shelf, an ofrenda bookshelf that we had, that you know, we bought and created, built together, me and my brother, my dad, and we have rashes there with a lot of family members. And I look at her every day, you know, talk to her every day, and you know, we're holding on to them until my dad passes, and then we'll bury them together. It's been really tough.
I'm so sorry. I know that doesn't mean much. However, I'm deeply sorry for your loss and for the ongoing trauma of then having to engage the system that is responsible.
Yes.
If you would, in your words, what happened to your mother in October of 2025?
So the incident happened on September 26th.
I apologize.
She passed away on October 3rd. She went to her family's residence to pick up her brother, who neurodivergent on the spectrum, but fully functional. My tio Ruben, she went to go pick him up. He had called her, made arrangements to take him to the doctors, and her sister, they're all siblings, her sister Sylvia, moved in after my grandmother passed away in 2018. She was almost 100 years old, 99. She didn't quite make it. But when she passed away, the sister Sylvia moved in, and things changed. Her and my mom were getting along for some reason. I don't know the specifics of it, but I tried to stay out of it. She had a big controlling influence on my tio Ruben. So she wouldn't take him sometimes to church. That was his identity. He loved going to church. And to his appointments. So he would call my mom for her to see if she could take him to church and to some of these doctor meetings or appointments. So my mom agreed. She loves, you know, seeing her brother and spending time with him. So she went to the house, I think around 10 o'clock that morning. And from what I have gathered from some witnesses, neighbors, that he was in the car with my mom. Sylvia came out, told him to get back in the house. So he listened to her and went back in the house, and my mom went to the door. The door was already shut, and she was banging on the door, trying to get him to come out. And then sister Sylvia ended up calling the police. And you could hear on the 911 call, just her exaggerating. And to give you some background, she worked as a dispatcher for the San Ramon. And I think she knew kind of what to say to get the police over there. She weaponized the police, in my opinion. And she had actually, I know I'm kind of jumping around here, but she had sent me a text about a month before telling me, hey, you know, mijo, when your mom comes, you know, we get into arguments, she would start harassing me. And I know that wasn't true. And, you know, I would just listen. I tried to stay out of it. And she asked, hey, make sure she doesn't do that when she comes over here. You know, I'm too old to have this negativity in my life. And if this continues, I will have to find a solution. So that really stuck out to me. And I still have that text. But anyway, so that day she calls the 911 and she seems really frantic and scared of my mom wanted to stay on the phone. So the police get over there. My mom's outside. And this is all from the video that they made public, the community briefing video, which was, in my opinion, produced, edited, and they added context on there. Yep. To fit their narrative. It wasn't the original unedited, body cam footage. So she is there talking with the female officer. You could obviously see my mom is emotionally distraught. She's crying. She has her sunglasses on, but you could see her wiping away tears, just saying, hey, I'm here to see my brother. And, the female officer is asking her all these questions, trying to identify her, which she already had that information, but she wanted her birth date and address. So my mom wasn't forthcoming with that information. She was being a little sarcastic in some of her answers. You know, when she asked for her birth date, my mom asked, you know, told her, "Why are you going to buy me a present?" So after a while, with the questioning, you could see my mom had enough. And so she was sitting down in her vehicle, which was parked outside the house, on the passenger side. And once she had enough, she kind of just got up and told her, "Hey, you know, I'm leaving." And she put up her hands and kind of walked past her. She wasn't fleeing or anything. At that point, the female officer, Danielle Tagia, didn't give her explicit orders that she could not leave, that this was an investigation to some serious crime or something. So she turns to Aaron Peachman, who was at the front door, at the doorstep, speaking with Sylvia, and tells him, "Peachman, she's leaving." So then he tells Sylvia to, you know, wait. And so you could see him run across the lawn. And I think once he realizes that she wasn't, you know, fleeing or anything, he ends up walking and he catches up to her. You know, he takes the front end of the car route. My mom went around the backside to go to the driver's side and gets to her and tells her, "Hey, you know, you're not free to leave. Go sit down. Or you're going to be arrested." And then at that point, my mom kind of was like, "You know, wait a minute, arrested? You know, I'm not going to be arrested." And then I think at that point, he didn't like the tone, or I don't know, but he ended up grabbing her arm and twisting it and saying, "You're arrested. We're going to take you to jail." And Danielle Tagia grabbed the other arm and they're twisting it. And my mom has had surgeries on her hands. She was an elderly woman. She had shoulder surgery and she's never been arrested, never been in trouble in her life. And they started manhandling her. She was passively resisting, obviously. Shouldn't have never have came to that point. None of that point did they de-escalate anything. Everything was escalated from that point on. They started walking her to the car. You could tell that she was in pain the way that they were twisting her arms, because he said, "I don't want to hurt you." And you could hear her say, "You are hurting me." Walks her to the car. The car's doors open. They kind of splice some things. And she doesn't want to get in the car. And then at that point, she says, "I want to call my husband." He starts pulling things out of her pockets. From one of the neighbors, he witnessed Aaron Peachman push her. The door was open. She hits her. You could see her hit her head on the door frame, and then she falls to her knees, and she screams in pain. You could hear that, and there's no response from him, none at all. He then tells her to get up, and she's kind of just in there, and I think she's in a daze the way that she hit her head. And tells her to get up, or he's going to force her in there. And she's still on her knees. And after a while, he pulls her up and he forces her in the back seat face first, shoves her in there head first. And Danielle Tagia goes around the other side, because my mom gets hung up on seatbelts that were still, you know, in the back seat. So she's kind of stuck there, handcuffed head first in a prone position. And she's crying and she says, "Hey, I've never been arrested." And you could tell the frantic nature of the terror in her voice. Danielle Tagia goes to the other side, unclicks the seatbelt, pulls her arm. And mind you, her arms are handcuffed behind her back. So when she pulls her arm, it's going the opposite way. And as I said, my mom had shoulder surgery. So she's screaming in pain. And she shuts the door. I thought, you know, at that point, before seeing the video, that she shut the door in her head, because that's what one of the neighbors had said. Not that she shut the door in her head, but that she pulled her in and shut the door. She didn't say, she pulled her in and sat her up and then shut the door. Rich, so I thought that she had.
Rich, I'm so sorry. We're about to run out of time. And I want to be sorry. Sure. No sorries. Listen, we will have you back, but it's really important tomorrow. So they said natural causes. Y'all fought back. Clearly, this was a 72-year-old woman. She was brutalized. That is the point. She was brutalized by law enforcement. And so
unnecessary.
Yes, it's absolutely unnecessary. Tomorrow, July 15th, there's a coroner's inquest, 8:30 a.m. at Martinez Courthouse, correct? Is that...
The coroner's inquest is at Wakefield Taylor Courthouse, 725 Courthouse Street, Martinez. The hearing starts at 9 a.m.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.